Phyllis Wheatley. In 1753, a baby girl was born on the western coast of Africa. Her mother did not sit for hours making beautiful little dresses and doing embroidery for her, for that is not the custom in Africa. Babies do not need many clothes in that warm country. There, little children, and grown people too, run around with just a piece of cloth tied about their waists. The child was not robust, but she grew and grew until she soon became her mother's companion. Her mother, believing that a great spirit lives in the sun, went out of her little thatched roof house every morning and prostrated herself to pour out water before the rising sun. The child often watched the water as it streamed down, and sometimes she jumped and clapped her little hands with glee. One bright morning, after this religious ceremony was performed and breakfast was over, the girl ran out to play with the other children. She was shedding her front teeth, but she was not large for her age, and she was none too strong. While she and her playmates were having a happy time, suddenly one of the older children exclaimed, "Hoi! Hoi!" Every child looked up and took to its heels. There were strange-looking men hurrying towards them. The children ran and screamed. Our little girl stumbled and fell, and the man, pursuing her, grabbed her. She kicked and yelled, but he held her fast. Her best friend ran behind a big tree, but she, too, was caught. They both kicked and yelled, but they were taken on board an American vessel. Other children who were caught were also brought to the shore, kicking and crying. When there were almost enough of them for a boatload, the vessel sailed away. They were on the water for many days. The voyage was long and the sea was rough. The waters lashed the sides of the vessel as it rocked to and fro. Some of the children fell to the floor with spells of vomiting. Many a night everything for a time was in complete darkness, and everybody was afraid. The little vessel, however, tugged away for days and nights, until it sighted lights flickering in the Boston Harbor. All the voyagers, tired and hungry and lonely, rejoiced to be nearing even an unknown land. Soon the boat pulled into the harbor, and although no comforts had been provided for them for the night, weariness of body so overcame loneliness of heart that all of them soon fell asleep. The news had gone abroad in Boston that a shipload of Africans was approaching. The next morning, many Bostonians hurried to the harbor to see the Africans. Among the number of spectators there was a Mrs. John Wheatley, the wife of a tailor. She walked around and looked many of the African girls over from head to foot. Finally, she handed the shipmaster money and took our girl away with her to her home. She and her daughter were busy for a while heating kettles of water, getting out clothing and sewing on a button here and there, preparatory to giving her a good hot bath. When the child was called in, she gazed at this strange-looking object, which Mrs. Wheatley called a tub. She looked at the soap and felt it. She stretched her eyes as she looked upon the nice white clothes on the chair. She seemed just a little afraid, and yet she did as Mrs. Wheatley told her and soon had her bath. After she was dressed, she met another big surprise. She was taken into a dining room where the table was all spread with white linen. There were strange-looking things to eat. She began eating, but said that the food did not taste like the food in Africa. She picked over this and picked over that, but nothing tasted just right. Nevertheless, she smiled, and it appeared that she was not very hungry. Mrs. Wheatley watched her closely as she came in touch with all of these strange new things and assured her that in a few days everything would not seem so queer. The girl adopted the customs of the family, and they named her Phyllis Wheatley. Every day as Mrs. Wheatley's daughter sat reading or writing letters, Phyllis stood looking at her in wonder. Miss Wheatley seemed to write with so much ease that one day Phyllis went out with a piece of charcoal in her hand and began to write on the side of a wall. Miss Wheatley, who was seated at a window, watched her for a long time, then called her in and showed her how to make some letters. Phyllis busied herself for the remainder of the day making letters and keeping Miss Wheatley busy showing her how to make new ones. That night she scarcely wished to leave her writing to go to bed, but Miss Wheatley persuaded her by promising to give her a lesson every day. They set the lesson hour, and Phyllis went to bed smiling and shaking with joy. Just at the right time every day, she walked into Miss Wheatley's room for her lesson. When her lessons were over and she was not busy with her work, she was poring over her books. In less than a year and a half, she could easily read the most difficult parts of the Bible without making a mistake. In 4 years, people in different parts of the country began to hear of her and write to her and even furnish her with books. To the surprise of the Wheatleys, she was soon studying and reading the Latin language without anyone to help her. At the age of 14, Phyllis began to write poetry. Often when some great person of whom she knew died, she would write a poem to commemorate his death. Sometimes she awoke during the night and composed verses, but could not recall all of them the next morning. As soon as Mrs. Wheatley discovered this, she began leaving a light and writing materials on the table at Phyllis's bedside every night. In cold weather, she always left a fire burning on the hearth in Phyllis's room. For 6 years, Phyllis was busy writing poetry and letters and studying and receiving visitors. Many people in England corresponded with her. The educated people of Boston were often seen making their way to the Wheatley home. They talked with Phyllis and questioned her, and often asked her to read some of her poetry. When she in turn went to their homes, they took great pride in showing her off as a wonder. Those who talked with her marveled at her knowing so much about English poetry, astronomy, ancient history, and the Bible. She continued to write and study. In her 19th year, she became so thin and pale that the family doctor advised Mrs. Wheatley to give her a sea voyage. Accordingly, the following summer, Phyllis set out for London with Mrs. Wheatley's son, who was going there on business. On her arrival in London, after days of travel, some of her friends with whom she had corresponded met her and welcomed her. As she visited the different ones, she went to dinner parties and theater parties given in her honor. When articles about her poetry began to appear in many of the leading London papers, her friends advised her to have all of her poems published. She considered the matter and went with some of them to see a publisher. After reviewing the poems, the publisher accepted them and published them in 1773 under the title Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral, by Phyllis Wheatley. As soon as copies of the poems reached America and were read, many people expressed doubt about the author being an African girl. The governor of Massachusetts and 17 other Bostonians, upon hearing this report, wrote a letter assuring people everywhere that these poems were written by Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley's London friends were making plans to present her to the King, George III, who was expected in London within a few days. But word reached her that Mrs. Wheatley was quite ill and wished to see her at once. Her passage was secured for her while she packed her trunk. As fortune would have it, a vessel was sailing that day for Boston. She bade her friends goodbye and put out to sea. The vessel moved slowly, but after days of travel it landed at Boston. She was met at the dock and hurried to the Wheatley home. Mrs. Wheatley caressed her again and again, and lay looking at her for days. For 2 months Phyllis waited upon Mrs. Wheatley and sat by her bedside night after night until she died. 4 years later another shock came to the family. Mr. Wheatley died. 7 months after his death, his daughter passed away, leaving Phyllis alone. Phyllis lived a short while with a friend of the Wheatleys, and then rented a room and lived alone. She lived in this way until she began to taste the bitterness of Revolutionary War times. At that time, one goose sold for $40 and 1/4 of a lamb sold for $50. One evening during these hard times, she met a handsome man by the name of Peters, who wore a wig and carried a cane. He also kept a grocery store, practiced law, and wrote poetry. He began at once to pay court to Phyllis. Later he called on her, often took her out for a stroll or to a party until they were married several weeks later. After the wedding day, Phyllis began her daily round of sweeping and cleaning, cooking and washing and ironing. As the years came and went, three children came into their lives. Mr. Peters failed in business and then left Phyllis to support herself and the children. She secured a job in a cheap boarding house where she worked every day from early morning until late at night. She became ill from overwork. During the first summer of her illness, two of her children died. The following winter, cold and snowy, some charitable organization placed in her backyard a load of wood. Although the wood lay there, Peters often went out, leaving Phyllis lying on her poor bed without a spark of fire on the hearth. She lay there for weeks. Friends and distant relatives of the Wheatleys often inquired about Phyllis, but no one seemed to know where she was. Finally, one December afternoon, in 1784, as a grandniece of Mrs. Wheatley chanced to be walking up Court Street in Boston, she met a funeral. Upon inquiry, she learned that it was the funeral of Phyllis Wheatley. Here are some lines from her poem, Imagination. Imagination, who can sing thy force? Or who describe the swiftness of thy course? Soaring through air to find the bright abode, the imperial palace of the thundering God, we on thy pinions can surpass the wind and leave the rolling universe behind. From star to star the mental optics rove, measure the skies and range the realms above. There in one view we grasp the mighty whole, or with new worlds amaze the unbounded soul.